Christian nationalism leans into that hard. It's freedom for me, and order and potentially violence for you or them.
Welcome to Dangerous Dogma, the authority on questioning authority. I'm Brian Kaler, president of Word and Way. You can learn more about us at wordandway.org. In this episode, we're going to have a conversation with Samuel Perry. He's the co-author, along with Philip Gorski, of the brand new book, The Flag and the Cross: White Christian Nationalism and the Threat to American Democracy. Sam is a professor of sociology at the University of Oklahoma, and he is a prolific researcher and writer. He's written a number of really important studies about Christian nationalism, which is the key topic in this new book, The Flag and the Cross. He also co-authored an earlier book with Andrew Whitehead, Taking America Back for God. There'll be a couple of references to that book in this episode, and they are both excellent, Taking America Back for God and The Flag and the Cross. So I was really excited to have Sam on this program because he's doing some important research to help us understand what's happening in the world of religion and politics today and why we should be alarmed. So maybe this isn't the best episode for bedtime listening, but it's an important episode, and I'm glad you're listening. And of course, you can learn more about Christian nationalism and the ways it's continuing to impact our politics and our churches by following more of what we do at Word and Way, our e-newsletter, A Public Witness. Learn more and subscribe today at publicwitness.wordandway.org. And now here's my conversation with Samuel Perry, co-author of The Flag and the Cross. Well, Sam, first of all, welcome to the program.
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
I'm really excited to have you on here to talk about the newest book that you're a co-author of, The Flag and the Cross: White Christian Nationalism and the Threat to American Democracy. And so I guess, you know, you sound almost like a communist there. I mean, what do you hate more, the flag or the cross?
No, actually, you know, I would like to think that our goals are to preserve the purity of both in some ways. We are not out to scuttle the influence of all religious belief or morals or values on politics. That's not something, and that's actually, I think, something that we get. If people want to misrepresent the work, they usually jump to some kind of conclusion that we're trying to keep Christians from voting their values, or we're trying to keep Christians from living out their faith in the public square. And that's one, I think that is actually an impossibility. I think we always vote our values, and we are shaped by our own experiences and structural location and socialization. And so religion is a part of that for me, as well as for a lot of Americans. Yet what we're trying to argue for is that there is a certain kind of tribal and ethno-cultural Christianity that looks to institutionalize itself and institutionalize a certain kind of hierarchical structure and order that is antithetical both to American democracy as we understand it, but it is also in many ways, and it's hard to do the normative thing. Religious studies people don't like it when I do this. Sociologists don't like it when I do this. But if I could be normative for a second and just kind of say, I think most American Christians, when I explain to them what Christian nationalism does and is about and what is associated with it, they would say that is inconsistent with what they think Christians ought to be. So I would say I agree. And I think what we're describing is inconsistent with what most Americans would understand Christianity and Christians to be about. So I'd like to think that we're trying to preserve both in that.
Yeah, and I think you do a great job of that actually in the book. I highly recommend the book. It's an excellent read, and I do encourage our listeners to grab a copy that is just now out this month. So let's stop just a moment and make sure we do our definitional thing just to help people along. So when we talk about Christian nationalism, and more specifically, this is, you know, a key in the book, white Christian nationalism. Right. Help us out. What do you mean?
Yeah, absolutely. So we define white Christian nationalism in most of our studies. We define it generally, or Christian nationalism generally, as an ideology that seeks to that idealizes and advocates. So it idealizes means it sets it up as this goal and this kind of sacred standard, but it also advocates. It holds it out as the vision. and idealizes and advocates a fusion of American civic life with a very particular kind of Christianity. So in the book, The Flag and the Cross, we talk about there's a deep story to Christian nationalism and there's a vision to Christian nationalism. So deep story is this kind of sacred myth that we have this special uniqueness, exceptional relationship with God. America is where God pays attention and always has because of our founding ideals and just who we are. But there's also a vision. It's not just, hey, this is what we have been, but this is what we should be. And this is the kind of society we should institutionalize, structure, and build. Now, what is that particular kind of Christianity? Whenever I say Christian nationalism, people want to push back and say, like, you know, this doesn't sound Christian. This is inconsistent with Christianity as I understand it. And I think that's fair. But what we're talking about in Christianity, in the Christianity of Christian nationalism, is more properly understood as an ethnocultural order. It is the idea. It is identities. It is values. It is traditions. It involves expectations about who is on top within the social order and who is excluded from that order, who is allowed to have power and who does not, who has liberty and who gets the law. And, you know, so I think Christianity in those terms, Christian nationalism looks to institutionalize that kind of understanding of Christianity. It's not about loving Jesus. It's not about loving your neighbor. It's not about the Orthodox creeds. It is about pro-traditionalist Christian ethnoculture. And I think that's what we're trying to talk about. So why do we call it white Christian nationalism, though? Let me be clear. Frankly, and we try to underscore this a lot in the book, and we demonstrate this through numerous charts and analyses, that Christian nationalism, our measures of Christian nationalism, which we do with a 7-item scale in the book, our measures of Christian nationalism operate very differently for white Americans than for Black Americans in particular. And this is because Christian language, the language of Christian nationalism, Christian values, Christian heritage, Christian nation, that is racialized. It's fundamentally racialized. And so when white Americans hear our questions about Christian nationalism, they seem to think nostalgically for a time where the right people and the right values held sway in America. When African Americans and other minority groups hear our measures, they don't think nostalgia for a time that we wish we could go back when all of the right people and all of the right values were institutionalized. They tend to think, it looks like they think more aspirationally, right? Like the kind of society America always should have been, but never was. So we call it white Christian nationalism because we think whiteness is a part of this story, that Christian nationalism, as we understand it, looks to institutionalize white Christian ethnoculture, not just generic Christian, but white Christian. A certain kind. So that is the particular kind of Christianity that we think about.
Yeah, and obviously, and we'll get to the last couple of years in a moment. Obviously, we've had a lot of attention to Christian nationalism recently, but it's not a new phenomenon. And this is one of the things that you all spend quite a bit of time in one of the chapters of taking a look back to, you call it the spirit of 1690. And so I wonder if you can help us understand that this thread, this idea of Christian nationalism, has always been here in American culture, even before there was a nation.
Right. So even before the nation was the nation, we see groups, majority groups in power, conflating nation, race, and religion. So before the revolution, we could trace this all the way back to the Puritans, and this is what Phil is talking about in chapter. To there, this spirit of 1690. And we wouldn't properly call it white Christian nationalism, even though that is what it's describing. You could more specifically call it, in that context, it would have been like Anglo-Protestant Britishism, or like white Protestant Britishism. You know, like it is there is this nation, there is this religion, this specific kind of religion, not Catholic, not Catholicism, not Christianity generally, but Protestant. And there is an idea of race as over and against the red people who were here when these British Christians came over, right? These are the enemy. These are the judgment of God on your own sins. These are the groups that need to be conquered or marginalized or boxed out. And so throughout America's history, white Christian nationalism has changed and evolved as the enemies have changed, as the circumstances have changed. The boundaries of that who is the us versus the them have contracted and expanded depending on who are the enemies and who are the outgroups at the time. Sometimes it includes Roman Catholics. Other times it excludes Roman Catholics quite explicitly. Sometimes it excludes Jews quite explicitly. Other times, like today, the language of Judeo-Christian America ostensibly includes that. And now I think white Christian nationalism is expanding so greatly that the theological content of that, and even some of the religious identity part of it, is no longer really relevant. You can be quite secular and be a Christian nationalist now, or a white Christian nationalist, because what you want is the white Christian ethnoculture. It's not necessary that you identify personally as a Protestant, a Catholic, or a conservative Jewish American. You can be secular, you can be an atheist, and yet you still want white Christian ethnoculture institutionalized as the moral standard, because in your mind, that's what people like us means. That's good moral values. That's good tradition. And these ought to be elevated, and other groups ought to be boxed out of the conversation, either legally or culturally or both.
Yeah, I think that's such an important point that you noted that, I mean, we're not dealing in terms of religious sincerity or Christian beliefs or even a deep understanding of theology,
no,
but that we're looking at much more of a political, cultural, social movement here that's just borrowing from a lot of the symbols and trappings of a faith.
Yeah, exactly. And so, and this is something we always try to specify, like people who I think you've got a couple of different groups who want to push back on the argument that we're making in this. I think you've got God and country, Christian nationalist folk, Christian nationalists who I think are for the most part are who we're talking about. Like they are voting with identity, and for them, all of this melds together. And then, the Christian language is just part and parcel of like this kind of good old fashioned traditional values of America as we know it and our way of life and that kind of rhetoric. And I don't think they understand theologically the roots of this, and they would make an argument for that. It's just how America was and how America should be. And that's where most, I think, Americans are generally. Like most Americans aren't partisans, and they're not, like well-informed or like really motivated to get involved. But then you have, I think, this other group of more intelligent, more theologically educated, more philosophically minded, conservative branches of either Christianity or just kind of the right that want to get in the weeds about like the theological arguments here and the Bible and those kinds of statements that can be made. And frankly, I feel like we end up talking past one another because most Americans don't know a thing about Piper. They don't know a thing about Richard Hooker, or they only know things about like the founding fathers from what they have been told, like just very pop culture kinds of things. And they're frankly not even thinking with that. Like they're not evaluating their own political beliefs and values on the basis of any kind of cogent or coherent philosophical or theological anything. So we can have intelligent arguments about that. And in some ways, I am persuaded by some of the things that they say. And so I'd be happy to talk about that. But I think what we're trying to do in our book is to say, look, empirically, this is associated. We can demonstrate in all kinds of different ways that this is associated with things that are not just, oh, look at those conservatives and how backwards are they, but things that are legitimately scary, things that are like legitimately like the pro-violence, seeing violence as imminent, belief in all kinds of conspiracy theories, rejection of vaccines, rejection of any kind of like legitimate COVID information. These are things that I think if we could recognize that Christian nationalism is an ideology, white Christian nationalism specifically, is associated with a lot of things and ideas and values and behaviors that we don't want to be associated with as a nation or within the Christian community as Christians, then I think we could actually, I think, move forward a little bit. Kind of piggybacking on that for a second, I am persuaded by the argument that America needs to be united around common values. Like that's like societies need to have a common identity, common values. And so I think on the right, we do get, I think, appropriate pushback to say, okay, well, what will unite us? Some of these thinkers and writers would say, well, it should be Christian ethnoculture because that's what America has been united around, and that is what has made us prosperous and successful. So it's a more sophisticated Christian nationalism there. I don't think that's consistent with our secular constitution. I don't think that's consistent with where we're going as a nation demographically. Certainly, I think that's just an impossibility now. It's not where we're going. Well, I actually am more more in line with a more of a creedal nationalism that, and you could call it patriotism, but if you want to call it creedal nationalism, it's just revolving around the ideas that are foundational within our, you know, Declaration of Independence, full legal equality, rule by the people, natural rights. You know, I think those kinds of things that we could all unite around and say, this is what makes you an American.
Yeah, I had a couple of questions actually about this idea of unifying, you know, national values. One of them, though, I think is really important in recognizing that part of the problem we have, and this is something that you all document in the book with your research, is that we don't have an accurate understanding of our national history. Right? So you write that this is not just a difference in worldview. It's not that Christian nationalists have a different understanding of American history. It's that they often have an incorrect understanding, but only if they are white. And so they white Christian nationalists tend to believe a number of things about particularly the role of religion in American history that just frankly aren't true. And so if we don't even have a foundational understanding of our nation's past, then no wonder we can't unify in the present.
Right. And there's two things going on there. One, there is a Christian nationalism industrial complex that exists to sow those kinds of narratives. Those mistaken narratives that America was founded as just almost, I mean, I've got on my shelf, I'm looking at it right now, the Jefferson Lie by David Barton, which basically, I mean, was so bad that the original publisher pulled it, and he had to publish it under a different thing, because he basically tries to make Jefferson look like some kind of evangelical, which is just the most irresponsibly, you know, like kind of narrative.
That's, I mean, the dude's literally cutting up the New Testament.
I mean, it's just, no, it's so far out there. It just got trashed so hard, and appropriately so. So, but you've got that whole industry, and up above my shelves, I'm looking at the Patriot's Bible, the Founder's Bible, the American Patriot's Bible for teens and for women. Falwell's Patriot's Bible, which he was one of the first ones to actually kind of make a Bible with all of this kind of interleafed, kind of paragraphs about America's rich heritage of, you know, Christianity. And so, like, you've got an entire industry that looks to educate, in quotes, American Christians on America's relationship with Christianity in order to promote this narrative that because Christianity made us prosperous, made us awesome, we need to preserve this with conservative values and conservative, you know, policies. But there is also something ideological going on. Like, it's not just Americans who score higher on Christian nationalism get these religious history questions wrong in our study because they just have the wrong information. It's because they ideologically, they want it to say that. They want it to say the Constitution mentions God's name and our obligations to him multiple times, which it does not. Or they want to deny or disagree that In God We Trust was our national model before the 1950s. Not true. Or that Under God was a part of the pledge before the 1950s. Also not true. You know, so if all these kinds of things, like it is not just misinformation, but it is also ideologically driven fantasy of just kind of a fictive idea of, like, this is the nation that I will commit to. This idea of my nation, even if it's just kind of completely divorced from historical fact.
Yeah. And then, you know, you all have this part early in the book where you all talk about there was this idea that maybe COVID, like some national disasters in the past, national crises, war, natural disasters, have unified the country. And there were some expectations that maybe COVID would do the same thing. And I mean, you know, spoiler alert to all of our listeners, it didn't happen. I mean, COVID has only exasperated all of the divisiveness and the polarization, the conflict we have. And you all write in part about this, that this happened in part because white Christian nationalism is ultimately about us, the good, decent Americans, versus them, the outsiders who wish to take what's rightfully ours. And it also shaped who Americans trusted for information during the pandemic. So I wonder if you can talk about how Christian nationalism has impacted what we have all experienced for the last couple of years during COVID.
Right. So white Christian nationalism is heavily tied to, and I believe it promotes this, white Christian nationalism is heavily tied to a kind of populist movement that we see in the United States among conservatives, conservative populism. And a part of populism, another way to say populism, if you don't understand that definition, is just anti-elite, extreme suspicion of the elites in all form. That means suspicion of the media, suspicion of scientists, suspicion of academics, suspicion of establishment politicians. Trump was able to play off of this wave of populist momentum on the right by being the anti-elite, by being the guy who is a disruptor. He is not an establishment politician. He doesn't trust the media. He hates the media. It's fake news. It's all lies. He bashes his own political party as established, you know, as insider establishment. It's the swamp, and I'm going to drain it. And he certainly doesn't, you know, and even before COVID, even before he was the president, I could show you the tweets. Trump had already shown distrust in science and science of vaccines. Even like Trump is an anti, his tweets have been used to promote anti-vax arguments, suspicions about connection with autism. One of my co-authors, Andrew Whitehead, not for this book, but for previous studies, we wrote an article on Christian nationalism and anti-vax attitudes. And Andrew is well steeped in this literature. Autism is in his family, and it's something that he has researched a lot and knows a lot about. And he was easily able to kind of draw the connection between this kind of anti-science populism within Christian nationalism and suspicion of all vaccines. And that was, you know, we could see like, okay, this is just going to be really hardcore anti-COVID vaccines as well, very suspicious. So what happened for a variety of reasons? One, you've already got this populist push within white Christian nationalism going on, but you also have Trump coming out in February. And again, we talk about these tweets in the book, but Trump immediately came out and he felt attacked. He felt like the Democrats were coming after him and blaming him and throwing him under the bus for this explosion of infection rates. And he was trying to say, hey, this isn't a big deal. They're just trying to make this up to hurt me and wound my chances at the 2020 election. They're trying to tank the economy. And they're in it with the media. Like like they're talking about like how the Democratic Party is in it with the left-wing media. And so right off the bat, he's already sowing distrust toward the Democrats, toward the media, towards the science, and saying, this isn't a big deal. And if you're in my tribe, basically, you're going to say, hey, like you're going to be skeptical of anything that's coming across. So right off the bat, we were primed by leadership and populism to be polarized on this immediately. So anything that the scientists or the academics or the media or the Democrats said we should do, folks were already primed politically to say, well, we need to do the opposite. We need to keep the economy open. We need to be suspicious of vaccine. We need to, you know, that and this isn't to say that like most Republicans did get vaccinated. So like I'm not trying, and most evangelical Christians got vaccinated. Even most Americans who are middle of the pack on Christian nationalism eventually got vaccinated. So I'm talking more in terms of statistical tendency, like who is more likely to be suspect, far more likely. White Americans who subscribe to Christian nationalism are more likely to not wear masks, go to public places and interact with others, not get vaccinated, still not get vaccinated. So there's a lot of things going on.
Yeah, as you had mentioned earlier, the scale for Christian nationalism that you all have used in a number of studies, you know, is linked to so many of these things, the support of violence in politics, the anti-vax, like, right. I mean, it really is a worldview that's having a significant impact on the way people act in the real world on so many of these key issues like COVID and vaccines.
Yeah.
And so it really has been a helpful way of understanding our current society and politics.
Yeah. And this is, you know, we have gotten more, I think, particular about avoiding categories of people in saying that, like I try to, and every once in a while I may slip and say this. And so like, you know, I'm sure people could point to examples, but if it is possible, if I'm conscious and aware enough to avoid it, I always try to avoid calling people Christian nationalists or white Christian nationalists, because it's like calling people Nazis or fascists or racists. Like it immediately shuts down conversation. It immediately activates team psychology, and you're just kind of, you know, you're on the defensive and you're, you know, trying to engage with this kind of label that you've been given. And nobody wants to be called those kinds of things. I prefer to talk about it, and I think, like we're doing right now, as a spectrum, like we do in the book, that white Americans can score higher or lower on this Christian nationalist ideology. And that ideology is influencing these folks to embrace different values and different kinds of behaviors and different viewpoints. And in something, they can be divorced from that. You know what I mean? Like they are not wrapped up. They are not completely just encapsulated by white Christian nationalism. That is their whole personhood and being. And so let's just call them white Christian nationalist as if that is some kind of clinical category. We prefer much more prefer to just so that we can continue to have conversations about why this is harmful and people will listen. We talk about it as an ideology that is unhelpful and toxic rather than people who are unhealthy and toxic. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I think it's a great point. And also, it's probably worth us highlighting here something you were just alluding to. And in both this book with Philip and your previous book you just referenced with Andrew, it's not that there's either someone holds Christian nationalism or they don't.
Right.
Right. And so there is this range. And so that we might have some people that are scoring, you know, at the top of the chart on Christian nationalism.
Right.
Some people might hold to like half of the values. And so we can kind of see the impact that even partial Christian nationalism philosophy can have on individuals. So that's also important. It's not like an either or issue as well.
Exactly. Exactly. It's a spectrum.
So obviously, there's a lot of things that you all write about and that we could talk about regarding the former president and the role that he had over the last 6 years in fomenting and adding to Christian nationalism. I wanted to highlight one thing that I thought was interesting in this book that I hadn't seen in some of your other or earlier work or from work that others have been doing. And you all talk about the blood metaphor and the way that that had already been in Christian theology, and then also then how Trump comes in and uses some of his own blood metaphors that kind of, I mean, bleed into each other here. And so I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, so Christian nationalism as an ideology, I think, inhabits a world of violence, where violence is understood. And it's just a matter of who has the violence and who is doing the violence. And so it begins in a violent world, and in the end it will be a violent end, right? Like it's an apocalyptic kind of view. And actually we found, and we talked about this at the very beginning of the book, that the Americans who seem to score highest on our indicators of Christian nationalism are Pentecostal holiness, more charismatic traditions. Political scientist Paul Jupe has actually done some really great work recently showing that it really is often the combination of that Pentecostal, apocalyptic, good versus evil theology and Christian nationalism, both of them together, that seems to produce and be necessary for really affirming political violence or political extremism in that kind of way. And that makes perfect sense. You know, you've got to feel aggrieved, like something that belongs to you has been taken from you in the Christian nationalism. But you also have to feel like this is a fight between good and evil that requires ultimate ends and sacrifice. And that kind of apocalyptic end times theology that it's going to be a day, an Armageddon, a rapture, and a time where like God's people must stand up and fight against these evil forces. So the metaphor of blood, I think, is consistent and runs through the history of white Christian nationalism, both in terms of like ethnic and racial separation between groups. That there's this idea of if not racial purity, an ethnic purity, certainly, and certainly a religious purity, but that idea of blood purity, but also bloody conquest, leading into bloody apocalypse. This idea of, I think, political and racial and religious violence is a thread that runs through white Christian nationalism throughout America's history, as I think Phil does such a great job of like weaving together in most of his contribution to this book. And we still see that kind of thing today. So like and this was kind of one of these things that we saw just really come together. We were talking about like how we saw this in history and we looked at the empirical data from what we have over the last couple of years and it seems that white Americans who subscribe to Christian nationalism view a world where violence is not something that is avoidable if one wants to maintain control over chaos. So white Christian nationalism, I think, really perceives the world in terms of chaos that needs to be controlled with righteous violence. So the best way to stop a bad guy with a gun is not to take away guns, it's to have good guys with guns, right, who can exercise righteous violence.
I've heard that.
You know, you maybe heard that around. So, and we find that association is linear, right? Like it is one of the strongest associations you could see. Why? Well, it's not just because it's a conservative talking point. We control for like Republican identification and political ideology and education. It is because white Christian nationalism really does see order or righteous violence as a means, not even just like if necessary, as a favored, you know, technique for being able to control deviants or problem populations. One question we have is that the biggest problem with the death penalty is we don't use it enough. And that's same story, right? Like the more you affirm as a white American, the more you affirm Christian nationalism, the more likely you are to say, yes, absolutely. That's just the problem. Supporting torture, supporting any means necessary policing to maintain law and order. It's that kind of thing. Belief that political violence is imminent, right? Like there is, it's, you know, like things have gotten so far off track. True American patriots may have to resort to violence for our country. So you don't believe, as white Christian nationalism sees this blood metaphor running through, not only in terms of like purity and separation, but also in terms of conquest, in terms of apocalyptic ends, where this is all going. And I think that's just a really, yeah, interesting hook there. And you can see this, like, you can see this in kind of the narratives, like when you go to a 4th of July celebration at First Baptist Dallas or some kind of church or some kind of Baptist church where celebrates a Freedom Sunday or a, you know, a Celebrate Freedom service. Oftentimes you will hear some, you know, they'll trot out some military veteran chaplain to give the message, or not even maybe a message, but they will, you know, certainly give a prayer, or they'll talk, and oftentimes they'll talk about like they'll equate patriots who died for America making the ultimate sacrifice with Christ who died and made the ultimate sacrifice for our sins, and so in equating those two, this idea of a bloody sacrifice on behalf of the group, it ends up conflating the nation and God's people together, does it not? So it's that kind of language that you can still see.
So I love how you just kind of mentioned a hypothetical of like, you know, if you happen to attend First Baptist Dallas, I mean, hypothetically, I mean, so like, you know, most recently I think was at Christmas, right? When Donald Trump spoke, I'm watching the live stream because I'm just as, you know, like problematic and like forcing myself to watch this stuff as you are. I'm visiting family, so I'm up in Iowa, so it's too far to like drive in that morning. So I'm watching the live stream and tweeting about it. And then, of course, you're sitting there in the sanctuary because you drove on down to see it in, you know, in person. So, I mean,
couldn't miss that.
Yeah. So, I mean, you know, tell us a little bit more. I mean, this isn't something really in your book, but I mean, what is it on the ground level? Because so much, I mean, you know, honestly, I was surprised how little media attention his remarks at that service received. I know you wrote about it at Time afterwards. We wrote about it at a Public Witness. In part, we went into the service in so much detail because no one else was really talking about it and writing about it. It was shocking. So what's it like? What are we not seeing in media coverage when we're not there at the ground level experiencing it like you were there in person?
Yeah, I'll say a number of things stuck out. So thanks for asking about that. I think it's a really important thing to talk about. So I think most of the folks I spoke to, and I tried to speak to a lot of people, I was waiting in line for hours with everybody else who, you know, and I was asking about like, why are you guys here? Where are you from? And most of the folks I encountered weren't church members. They were folks who had come from around the area. And it was a Trump fest, right? Like it wasn't a Christmas service they were coming to. They were coming to a rally. They were coming to see Trump and they wanted to know what he was going to say. And they were huge fans. I talk about this a little bit in the article, but I mean, I think they all thought, you know, either stole an election or definitely thought like there was funny business going on. One guy in front of me said that he thought Trump ought to be made president for life. You know, like, and he said, I mean, he announced it, like he was just talking about it, like, everybody, we're all friends. And so, you know, he just didn't assume that there was like the sociologist who was there, I guess, taking notes. What did you say? Okay. And so you people were basically there for a Trump rally. I mean, and when Trump spoke, You didn't catch this in anything. I wasn't able to take pictures like that, but it was just a sea of phones, you know, catching the speech, right? Like it was not about, yeah, Robert Jeffress, get over it. You know, your sermon, blah, blah, blah. Like, let's talk about this kind of, you know, let's talk about Trump. And they fawned over him. Like this was a, like Robert Jeffress multiple times talked about it. It was the privilege of his life to be friends with Donald Trump. He was this greatest president, the most pro-Christian, pro-Israel, pro-life president we've ever had in the history of our country. I mean, it just gushed. Now, you probably, all pastors would probably do that if a president or like an ex-president was sitting in your church. I mean, you would talk about them highly. You know, the other things that stuck out, like this is towards the end at the end, Trump starts his USA chant. And he goes, USA, you know, like he just does that. He's walking off and people start going USA. And the people behind me, I'm sitting towards the back, but the people behind me change the chant to start saying, we love you, we love you. And this became like this, you know, this big chant to kind of chant him off stage. So this was no doubt like a rally, a mixture of like love for, you know, religious people, but love for this leader on their own. But the other thing that stuck out to me, and I had never noticed this before, just being able to observe Trump and his rhetoric on the spot in a speech. Trump had no idea what he was talking about. Like there were two kinds of things that he was supposed to talk about. So he was supposed to give this like this Christmas message. And I guess maybe he let this slip, or he was giving away the ball game. Like Trump goes up and he basically does his riff. Like Trump riffs. Like he does not like, you know, set speeches. He just kind of talks his feelings. And so he was doing that. And it was the standard thing. America's going to hell in a handbasket. It's chaos. It's we're not doing very well. It's all of these things. And he just kind of listed like inflation and, you know, all these things that, you know, so that he could say, hey, since I've been gone, it's all just going to crap. So like, that's when he's like looking at the audience because he's just riffing. But then he, you know, whenever he has to say anything religious, he looks down at his notes because he's obviously reading remarks that have been prepared for him. And he literally said that. He said, and they've written for me, blah, blah, blah. And he goes on and gives this kind of, you know, message about Christmas or Jesus and those kinds of things. But I found myself kind of amazed, frankly, that people didn't make the connection that like this guy really doesn't know anything about Christian faith at all. I mean, he doesn't have a sincere bone in his body when it comes to actually knowing anything about the Bible, about Jesus, about Christmas even. And he was supposed to, this was his thing. Like I'm the pro Christmas guy. Like I bring back Christmas to say Merry Christmas again. And just, you know, I think it was just a really astonishing kind of experience going, and I'll go to all of them if I can't. Like I'll, you know, if he comes back, I'll see these again. Man, this is great data. It is just fascinating to see how people respond to him, how they talk about him, his interaction with the crowd, and how they lean into that that personality that he exudes and just love him. Yeah, there were no people holding their noses and you know, voting for the team rather than the coach on this. This was all very much Trump love.
Yeah, I mean, I think it gets real perfectly into one of the things I wanted to ask you about, because we've talked a little bit about the kind of apocalyptic and end times and how that's mixed in even with QAnon, which we haven't gotten to as much, but you all show how that mixes in with that kind of historic end times theology. But then really related to that concept, you also write about the messianic nature of Christian nationalism, and Trump has definitely kind of benefited from this sentiment. So I wonder if we got to talk about that aspect. I mean, I guess it seems natural if everything's going to hell in a handbasket and we're being persecuted, which is something that, you know, is high on the Christian nationalism scale, believing that white Christians are uniquely persecuted, then you need a Messiah or a savior or somebody to step in at that moment. But it makes sense. But I wonder if you can talk more about how that has figured in, particularly these last few years.
Yeah. So Donald Trump, from the beginning of his presidency and on the campaign trail in 2016, he framed post-Obama. I shared about this on Twitter earlier. Tony Perkins comes out and explains, you know, they were willing to forgive Trump and give him a mulligan for anything because we felt kicked around by Obama and his leftists. And Trump was the guy who was on the playground willing to punch the bully. They really did view him as a savior against the leftists, right? Like this America will be taken from us and it's going to go down this long slide quickly under a Hillary Clinton presidency and later under a Biden presidency toward not just, you know, lack of prosperity, but towards like moral chaos. And so Trump, and with that involved persecution. Like I've got all of these quotes that talk, you know, Trump would say Christianity is under siege, you know, assaults on Judeo-Christian values, and Christianity is under attack, and we are, you know, so telling Christians they're being persecuted, but within that saying, I am the president who will stop that. I'm the president who will come to your rescue. You don't need anybody else. He promised them Christianity will have power. We're going to say Merry Christmas again. We're going to stop cold the attacks on Judeo-Christian values. And he even ramped that up in 2020. That every Democratic candidate right now is plotting to silence our churches and to cast God out of the public square. And we will never abandon Christianity as the foundation of our nation. And so you can actually see this in how Americans responded on our surveys right before the 2020 election. We asked Americans, how much discrimination do you feel like white Americans and Christians experience now? how much would they experience under a Trump presidency and how much would they experience under a Biden presidency? And it's just as you would think. Like they thought the more you affirm Christian nationalism as a white American, the more likely you are to say whites and Christians are persecuted now, right? Like, so it goes up. Under a Trump presidency, it stays basically flat, like that you thought Trump would basically get away. You know, if Trump wins, he's going to get rid of all of the persecution against whites and Christians. But under a Biden presidency, it takes off completely. I mean, just this astronomically like leap that if you feel it, the more you subscribe to Christian nationalism as a white American, under a Biden presidency, you thought persecution of whites and Christians was imminent. It was inevitable, and there was going to just be a lot of discrimination targeted towards these groups. And so think about how that would be motivating. Think about how that would be drive a group to the polls. Like we know that what makes people vote? Well, it's not issues. Like people just don't. I mean, it's sad to say, like political science has just kind of shown over and over again, what really gets people to the polls is fear and anger and identity. and Trump was actually, I mean, you know, I don't ever accuse Trump of somehow being some kind of psychological genius and playing 3D chess while all of us are just kind of, what's he doing? You know, he doesn't know, but he knows what works, and that what works is anger and fear. Bannon basically said this. You know, there's a quote, and I can't quote it verbatim, but he just said, like, our goal is to fill the airways with, you know, like the SH word, right? Like our goal is to fill the airways with that. We got elected on lock her up, drain the swamp, build the wall, anger and fear drive people to the polls. And so the guys who masterminded this whole thing know exactly what's going on. Is you got to tell your base that you're in trouble. People hate you. If they get in power, they're going to exterminate you or persecute you or discriminate against you. And so, you know, regardless of what the facts on the ground are, you know, if you can make people angry and fearful, you can win enough in strategic electoral districts to carry the electoral college.
We'll be right back with the rest of our conversation, but first I want to let you know about more of what Word and Way has to offer besides just this podcast. If you are looking for thoughtful Christian analysis of current events to help you make sense of our crazy world of faith, culture, and politics, then you need to subscribe to A Public Witness, an email newsletter from Word and Way. Learn more and subscribe today at publicwitness.wordandway.org. And now, back to this conversation.
Well, we haven't even talked about January 6th yet, which is where you all, of course, opened the book. But honestly, what I think is, you know, really important about what you're making the argument in this book is that, you know, too much of the attention about Christian nationalism is about January 6th. Like, oh, that's a January 6th thing. And what you're really trying to help us understand is that it is so much beyond that. And so, and in fact, this is a little bit what you write towards the end of the book in the chapter about avoiding the big one. It's tempting to dismiss the insurrection as an isolated incident perpetuated by a few bad actors. And then a little bit later, you write that the insurrection was an eruption of subterranean forces that had been building for some time. These forces have not disappeared. On the contrary, they are building again. A second eruption would likely be larger and more violent than the first, large enough to bury American democracy for at least a generation. So on that hopeful note, I mean, it's an important warning. I mean, you all really lay into the warning in this chapter that American democracy is at risk still. It's a clear and present danger. It didn't end on January 6th.
Right. Yeah. And I think that's exactly what we are trying to argue in the book, is that what woke so many Americans up was January 6th. Like, we were talking about Christian nationalism for a long time. We had already written our, you know, book. Andrew Whitehead and I had already written this book. In response to Trump and Trumpism and all of these things that we were going on, and then January 6th happens, and everybody's like, whoa, this, you know, I saw crosses and I saw Jesus save signs, and what's with that prayer on the Senate floor in Jesus's name? And it's just kind of, you know, what is this? And so what the argument we're trying to make is that, like, don't think of this as a fringe, weird kind of thing. Like, yes, that was an extreme example of what can happen when Christian nationalist ideology combines with just a mob. And they are angry and they are activated by a savvy politician who knows how to stoke that kind of like fear. But what we're looking at is we're actually looking at an eruption of forces that have been building, that have been there underneath the surface for a long, long time. So what we're trying to do is we're trying to explain what are these forces that can produce future eruptions, future chaos. And yeah, it is a darker, but so we wrote Taking America Back for God, Andrew Whitehead and I did in 2020, or published it in 2020. And if I tell everybody, if that book is the Star Wars, the flag and the cross is the Empire Strikes Back, because it is a darker book, because things got worse, right? Like after January 6th, I mean, you have got a consistent percentage of conservative Christian Americans who still believe the election was stolen. They're being told the election was stolen. They are trying to pass laws to reduce and eliminate, or at the very least reduce access to the vote in response to a debunked conspiracy theory about a big lie, right? Like the idea that we could stoke enough kind of rumor and fear about a voter fraud to where Republican politicians in red states would be able to pass laws to say, well, even if that wasn't true, the political will is there now to really try to pass some laws to try to make sure that we make it harder for make voter fraud more difficult, even though that is a non-existent problem. What it will do is it will limit the voter access of certain problem populations that they don't want to be able to vote. Young people primarily, and old and African Americans, or minority communities who are more likely going to vote Democrat. So I think you have got this. We face a challenge. We face it doesn't have to be a dark future, but we could face a dark future if we don't, I think, unite. So I think if there's a hopeful note at the end of that, at the end of the book, and we do try to strike, if not a hopeful note, at least a charge for action at the end. And it involves cooperation. It involves like not us versus them. We shouldn't play into, I think, the rhetoric that only helps the far right. Like when we get in there and we just start accusing people of being, five different identities that are all horrible, and when we don't talk about this as some kind of like a problematic ideology, but we talk about it as people that we oppose and it's us versus them, I think that plays into that persecution narrative, because then they really can say, look, they hate us. Look, here's a quote. They hate us, and then they can kind of build on that. But when we actually talk about a problematic ideology and say that this is a problem, we can unite alongside it. And I've been privileged to be able to do this last for the privileges of my life, to be able to unite alongside people who believe, frankly, different things. We come from different theological backgrounds. I'm on panels now with Jamar Tisby, who's a pastor, has a seminary degree, and I have a seminary degree. We're on panels with Christians. And then I'm sitting on a panel next to me with, Andrew Seidel, who is an atheist and previously worked for the Freedom From Religion Foundation, and now works for the America United for the Separation of Church and State. And we are talking about, we're uniting together in our common opposition to what we consider to be a problematic ideology. It's going to take those kinds of coalitions. It's going to take evangelical never Trumpers like David French or Russell Moore or Tim Keller and cooperating with folks like Seidel and saying like, hey, this thing is a problem. And so let's address it. Let's marginalize this in the conversation, not the people, but marginalize this ideology as something that is negative, so that we can actually cooperate and have, I think, productive government, productive conversations. We can hopefully heal some wounds.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, the end of the book, you all are both offering a stark warning and then also that call to action. Like you said, maybe not quite hopeful, but a sense of, well, the work can be done, but we've got to build these coalitions. And obviously there's a lot more research that's continuing to be done and work that's continuing to be done. And it's exciting to see. I mean, I know that you mentioned Andrew Seidel and you and Jamar Tisby and others were involved in a report that was even mentioned recently, by a member of United States House of Representatives. So like there's some growing attention to the danger here. And if we don't understand the danger, then we're not going to appropriately respond.
Right.
And so I would encourage people to follow you on Twitter. You're always offering more research there. I had one last question for you, and it was actually related to you are always posting your little charts of the new things that you were finding. And you posted one a couple of days ago that I found really fascinating on this line of thinking about the kind of inherent anti-democratic, small d, anti-democracy aspect that we see with Christian nationalism. But you were talking about the percentage of Americans who say that freedom of speech, press, guns, or religion is our most important right. And I found it really fascinating as you walk down the Christian nationalism scale. So as we get higher to adherence of Christian nationalism, that we see the freedom of speech and the freedom of press both declining dramatically, and the right to bear arms as our most important right escalating dramatically.
Right.
And so even like we have this disagreement over even what rights are important. And I think that that is also a bit, so people can continue to find more research to help us understand this problem.
Yeah, I think, and I think what we're looking at there is consistent with, this is from new data. And in fact, we're always collecting new data. While I was in Santa Barbara this past week, we got a new wave of survey data that I haven't even dived into yet. And I'm so excited. Just, you know, it's like a kid on Christmas morning. I'm ready to open up.
You look like it. I can see it on your face. You're so excited.
I'm ready. But I'm excited because I think we're just always, as the academic in me. So like as a citizen, I'm alarmed by these kinds of things. And as a Christian, I think I am somebody who wants to, I think, steer my people in a more positive, pro-democratic, pro-social kind of direction than they have been going. And yet I think what we're finding is consistent with the things that we have been saying all along, that this is a ultra-conservative, borderline, proto-fascist kind of ideology that really is characterized by, I think, Francis Wilhoitz, this political scientist. And I shared this on Twitter the other day, but he was describing conservatism, and I don't know if this is completely fair, but he basically said that, you know, the summary of conservatism as he understood it, and I would just say Christian nationalism politics as well, that there must be groups for whom the law protects but does not bind, over and against groups for whom the law binds but does not protect. And I think that is what we see when we get to, like, say, rights language, that Christian nationalism leads Americans, white Americans in particular, to say, liberty for me, in terms of my freedom and my guns, and to do anything I want, to avoid vaccines and to not, you know, to go out in public and get people sick if I want to and that kind of thing. But for you, authority, right? Like, you get authoritarian policing, you get the death penalty, you get, you know, torture if that's necessary. You know, like, I think that is, Christian nationalism leans into that hard. It's freedom for me, and order and potentially violence for you. Or them.
And that is inherently anti-democratic. That's a threat to our democracy.
Exactly. Yeah.
Well, the book is The Flag and the Cross, White Christian Nationalism and the Threat to American Democracy by Philip Gorski and Samuel Perry. Sam, thanks so much for joining us on the program and for writing this book. I really encourage people to pick it up because I think it's an important warning that we all need to hear and then respond to.
Thanks so much for having me.
Well, I hope you enjoyed this episode of Dangerous Dogma. You can find more information and links in the show notes at dogma.wordandway.org. And don't forget to check out our website, wordandway.org, to learn more about our other offerings, including A Public Witness, a subscriber e-newsletter to help you make sense of faith, culture, and politics. If you've enjoyed this episode, I hope that you will share it with your friends on Facebook and head over to iTunes or your favorite podcast platform and write a positive review. It really will help more people to find the show. If you'd like to give to support this program, we greatly appreciate it. And all you have to do at wordandway.org is hit the donate button. And whatever you give there will help support the production of this podcast, as well as our website, monthly magazine, and other offerings. If you have any comments or feedback about this program, you can send those to me at bkaylor@wordandway.org. Thanks for listening.